Already started your lunch, I notice.
A banana.
Food, glorious food. Hot sausage and mustard.
While we're in the mood. Cold jelly and custard.
No. Custard.
Custard.
No, come on. Custard.
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 No.
Don't worry about it.
No. Come on.
Custard.
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 There. See? If something was doing, it's was doing correctly. Mustache.
This is Infants on Thrones.
Listener Essay.
Hey there, listeners. Jake here. And today's very special guest is Nick Bigney, who contributed a rather excellent essay about food. Well, I mean, it's kind of about food, but it's also about other stuff. You know, why don't we just get into it?
The six waiters, one for each of us and two extra, approached our well-appointed table, four silver cloches covering an equal number of elegant plates. Amidst the chatter, the tinkling of glass, the soft lighting befitting a Manhattan restaurant of this caliber, they lifted the oversized lids in unison, a flourish of steam and fragrance obscuring the food every bit as well as the silver. And then, in a moment, there it was, a seared medallion of liver, no larger than a half dollar, contributed by some poor goose, likely fed to expiration by the hands of an indifferent Frenchman. As I set my will to somehow gagging down the miserable smear on my plate, one question kept coming back to my mind. How in the world had I, a casserole-eating boy from Utah, gotten here in the first place? There are very few foods in Utah as big as casserole. It is the one true dish. Some people will make a pitch for funeral potatoes, others for jello, but neither can be considered a true staple, the framework upon which the culinary stylings of an entire culture are built. Styles can vary, but the traditional offerings of my youth invariably rested on a foundation of cream of mushroom soup, canned and lifeless vegetables, overprocessed low-grade meat, and perhaps some cheese. Worship of casserole was a state obsession. I'm so thankful for this casserole, and know that it is true. I'm so happy because I have casserole in my life. I would definitely be a homeless bum without it. Here, have some more casserole. It is delicious to the taste, and very desirable. Outbursts of devotion such as this were often followed by an exposition of the holy recipe book of casseroles, or perhaps a song filled with effulgent praise for the great cook who had authored it, and who had come from humble beginnings to restore the casserole truths that had been lost from so long ago. And then we would remind ourselves how important it was to stick to casserole and nothing else. So that's the way I grew up. Casserole. All the time. We met once a week to worship casserole. We had weekly activities with casserole-themed topics. Every so often, a casserole expert would stop by and lecture us on the wonders of casserole. And the topic of discussion at home, at school, at play? Casserole. Years of casserole have a way of making you soft, gushy, complacent, and unwilling to move your own substantial girth around to look at much else. And contemplating nothing but casserole had made my mind just as bloated and sedentary. Occasionally I would cast a lustful eye at a hamburger. Once or twice I even had to confess inappropriate thoughts about a watermelon, but I always returned, like a dog to her vomit, straight back to casserole. One night I was searching for new recipes to spice up the increasingly bland casseroles I was eating when I happened upon a random bit of information. The great cook, it said, hadn't really written the holy recipe book of casseroles after all, but had rather plagiarized it from myriad other sources dealing mostly in meatloaf and lasagna. Poppycock, I thought. Pay no heed to those anti-casserolites. I'd been warned about them. Nothing they said had any effect on my actual food. But for the first time in a while, a new thought found a tiny place in my corpulent mind. Later, while reading up on the newest uses of canned green beans, I happened upon another anti-casserolite. This one was even bolder. Not only had the great cook stolen all of his recipes, he declared, the whole restoration of casserole truths was a myth, since casseroles had not, in fact, been around since the dawn of time, and could not, therefore, be restored. And that meant that casserole was not the one true dish. Well, this served me a bit of a nasty knock. If casserole was not the one true dish, why had I been eating nothing else all this time? Thinking such thoughts was too much for my portly and feeble brain, so I set off to find somebody who would help me find meaning in my menu. I found some somebodies all right, but not the somebodies I wanted or needed. They were the casserole polemicists. They explained very carefully how the great cook hadn't really plagiarized at all, since all those ideas were remnants from all the old ones who made their casseroles in years gone by. And just because nobody could find any evidence of actual casserole dishes, even though the spaghetti people had been finding ancient pasta makers for years, it didn't mean that the old ones had never worshipped at the altar of the one true dish. Oh, and by the way, those anti-casserolites? They suffered from indigestion, so they weren't believable anyway. Well, this made no sense to me. And why should it matter if the anti-casserolites had indigestion? I contemplated this late one night, unable to sleep, suffering from heartburn due to that evening's fare. It didn't help that I'd discovered earlier that day that the great cook liked sneaking a bit of cherry pie on the side, sometimes stealing it from his neighbors. I thought all night, until finally it was time for breakfast. I sat down to the usual and took a bite, but all of a sudden the casserole turned to ash in my mouth. The flavor was gone, or at least so it seemed. No longer that familiar mix of soggy beans, mass-market cheese, and unsatisfying crunch, it was a naked and exposed slab of tasteless calories. I fell in a slobbering heap of blubber to my knees and threw up. But one does not simply walk away from casserole. Not at least when it has been all you have known for years, and not when it was still what you had at every meal. So I stuck with it for a while. But I started reading up on it. I'd always been taught as a kid that there was nothing good about learning about casserole, that I should just leave the topic alone and accept it, that the deliciousness of the one true dish was all I needed. So I felt more than a little bit guilty. But I had to know everything I could, and boy did I learn, about how casserole was a modern invention, how it had been created by people who didn't know how to cook at all, how it was not just a fraud as the one true dish, it was also ridiculously unhealthy. Wait, what? Unhealthy? How could it be unhealthy? I mean, you've got your dairy from the cheese, there's protein in the ground beef, you got some of the mushrooms in the soup, and all those green beans. I mean, how can the green beans be bad for you? You know, vegetables and all that. This was confusing. Even though I didn't believe in the concept of the one true dish anymore, I was still eating casserole, afraid to upset the delicate balance of my family. I mean, once I'd hinted to my wife that I didn't always like the extra helpings of casserole, and she thought I didn't love her anymore. So I'd hidden my true feelings. But unhealthy? Well, that changed everything. As I read more and more about nutrition, the fat in the cheese and the cream of mushroom soup, and the canned beans with their few nutrients and tons of sodium, the more I realized that the past was irrelevant. Where casserole came from, or whether or not it was the one true dish, wasn't the important point. It was the present, the casseroles I was eating today, that were causing me to rot from the inside. So one night, I turned to my wife and I asked if I could just have some green beans from dinner. Not from the can, mind you, but fresh ones. "Look, I know it's not how we do things now," I pleaded, "but in the past they must have used fresh green beans. And surely it can't be wrong to just eat the beans, seeing as they're a part of the casserole, right?" Cautiously she agreed, and I rushed out to buy a new fresh batch of snap beans, on the sly, lest anybody see. That night I washed them, steamed them, and then just sprinkled them with a little bit of salt, and nothing more. Ah, the taste of those first beans! Manna from heaven they were, sweet and crispy and unladen with the processed flavors of 1,000 horrible ingredients. My first step into a larger world. It wasn't long until I moved from green beans to broccoli, and broccoli to tomatoes, and tomatoes to peaches, and peaches to chicken, and chicken to steak, and then pot roast with potatoes, and spinach salad with feta, and omelets with all sorts of ingredients, and finally full 7-course meals involving the seared liver of an overfed goose obscured by silver lids and steam. Some of the foods, most of them really, were magnificent, and I took great glee in rolling them on my tongue, combining them with other great flavors, and adding them to an ever-growing experience of taste. Others, like the goose liver, were not particularly to my liking, but I still counted it a great joy to add them to my experience. Each new meal was exciting and wonder-filled. One day I told my wife how I felt about casserole, how I really felt. She thought about it for a long time, and she said nothing. For 2 years, she let me embark on my heretical journey with nary a word. But one day, out of the blue, she told me that she didn't believe in the one true dish concept either. She still liked casserole, and she'd probably still eat a lot of it, but she wasn't opposed to a steak now and again either. So from that point on, I never ate casserole again. And my wife and I discovered the pleasures of eating out on occasion, too. I lost all the slothful girth, and as I ate more and more delicious things, I felt better about myself. I learned to consume in moderation, and I started exercising both my body and mind. The complacency of comfortable couches faded into memory as I spent more and more time looking for new experiences. Some of them weren't even related to food. Now, I don't know what foods I will try next. I don't know if what I'll try tomorrow will cause my lips to pucker in disgust, or if it'll make my mouth tingle with delight. But what I do know is that I'm free. Free to enjoy, free to eat from the magnificent spread placed before me without reservation. Some things I'm scared to try still, and others I have no desire to consume. But at least now I know that I can choose. And that knowledge, the knowledge of the buffet of my own experience, is far better than anything the casserole has to offer.
So if you could just kind of explain a little bit about your background in the church and just in general, kind of where you're coming from.
Yeah, I grew up in a small town, Utah, actually not far outside of Park City. And I say Park City, but it's really much more rural than that. Between there and Utah County, I spent my entire life until I went on my mission in what was very much a TBM, Bruce R. McConkie Mormon doctrine family. Oldest of, well, there's a lot of us, seven kids. And so I got my fair share of experimentation as the oldest. But we were definitely a go to church every Sunday, believed it 100% type of a family. Sundays, you know, they off limits sort of activities filled the spectrum of what we could do. In fact, it was nothing more than really kind of come home, maybe see the grandparents, but mostly just take a nap and read books. It was kind of a boring day. We left Utah on vacation quite a bit, actually, in my teenage years, but I did not live outside of Utah or really get immersed in anything outside of the Mormon church, I'd say, until at least my mission, and I don't think that really counts. Missions are, I don't care where you are, they're kind of a retrenchment.
Definitely.
An indoctrination camp, if anything.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a big part of the essay, right, is this, there's just this kind of status quo, this bland status quo that you've come to accept, and then, you know, you're opening yourself up to all these different experiences.
I think that's right. The option of having other experiences hadn't even occurred to me until much later. I came back off of my mission. I served in Japan and in Tokyo, had a great time there. But then, you know, very entrenched, came home like most missionaries do, sort of criticizing their TBM family for not being TBM enough, which I'm sure my parents appreciated to no end. Did the typical BYU thing, met my wife there. We were very much as solid believing as you could possibly be. And then we went to grad school back in New York, and that's where everything changed.
Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't until I don't want to equate everything I'm doing with you, but it wasn't until I kind of left the Morador, as they call it, that I just didn't even freaking understand that there was like all this stuff out there. There was this whole world that like I had not even been privy to or even acknowledged really in any real way.
Well, and the scope at which your viewpoint was challenged is very narrow. I mean, you're challenged as to whether or not, you know, caffeine is okay, right? And for the record, I thought it was, mostly because I was too lazy to stay up late at night with anything else. And energy drinks hadn't really come on the scene at that point. So in 2002, we packed up, we had a couple of kids, we moved to New York City, and...
Can I ask you one question?
Sure, yeah.
When did you serve your mission?
I served from 96 to 98.
Did you serve... No, my brother was in Okinawa. I have a brother that served in the Okinawa mission. Mm-hmm. Around that same time, but I just realized that it was a completely different island, so I'm way off. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah, at any rate, we went to law school back in New York, and law school is one of those times where they really sort of push your thinking, right? And so you're supposed to examine your own biases. You're supposed to start thinking logically, create arguments, that kind of a thing. And at that time, a lot of stress. It's, you know, a lot of homework. My thinking's been challenged a lot. It's no longer easy like everything had kind of been up to that point. Something weird happened. 2002, the Nauvoo Temple was dedicated. And like everybody else, I'm excited about this. Oh, you know, maybe next one's Missouri. We're going to be heading back there soon. So let's make sure we have our you know, horses, wagons, and 2 years supply. This had actually occurred to me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I lived in a very apocalyptic, like, it's a very apocalyptic mindset. So I totally know what you're talking about. Yeah,
half convinced the world was ending at Y2K. I had a friend of the family explain to me exactly how it was going to cause a banking crisis and how that matched up with Revelation. And it seemed all perfectly normal to me. I'm looking up the Nauvoo Temple. I'm excited about it, and I happen upon a story online. And the story is very simple. It's talking about, you know, how this new temple's been built. It's an AP News story, so we're talking legitimate news source. And there's a picture in it, and the picture shows some people dressed in front of a wall of dolls, and it said so and so stands in front of a wall with the dolls representing the 37 wives of Joseph Smith. My head exploded at that moment. I said, what? That's not – I've never heard of that before. That all started with Brigham Young, and it was about population increase and raising up seed and all of these sorts of things. So I got really confused. I didn't know what to do. This couldn't be, you know, maliciously wrong. It's a reputable news source. And then it occurred to me I really didn't know all that much about our history. So – I decided to start researching it, reading it, figuring out what was there. It was actually a great time to do it. In that ward, where one of the founders of one of the major blogs in the blogosphere was in the same ward, and so he was just starting up at that time, kind of exploring that. Richard Bushman was just finishing up Rough Stone Rolling in that ward. Some of the people who are in the foreword that he thanks were actually ward members who were, you know, again, very educated, you know, people who had proofread it for him. So it was kind of a little bit of an exciting time to be getting into that. But it freaked me out a little bit, and I didn't really know who to talk to about it. You know, with law school going on, I didn't have a chance to process it properly and kind of just packed it all in and didn't really deal with it. Couldn't tell my wife about it at all. She knew I was distant, but didn't know why. We, you know, ended up fighting quite a bit. You know, looking at it from her perspective, it probably seemed like I was having an affair or something, sneaking around on the internet, not letting her see what's going on, you know.
Yeah.
So I hit kind of a point where I was trying to decide what we were going to do. Spent a few years sort of thinking that through, had lots of friends in the church, but was really questioning it. And then we went back to Utah for a summer and then moved back out east to start working after I was done. This is in 2005. And on the way back, you know, we were kind of new parents. We'd kind of been joking around, you know, with others that, well, gosh, we don't know much about parenting at all, except, you know, keep them alive till they're 8 and then get them baptized. And then we failed at that one with our oldest. She had a really sudden, it was actually cancer, but it was a 24-hour thing where she had a headache one day and was dead the next, and literally that fast.
Oh my gosh.
At that point, you know, you kind of do what you have to survive. We had some church members open up their home to them. I still, you know, think of them as just great people, and you know, to the extent that I believe in anything, you know, whether you want to call it Christ-like attributes or just plain charity, you know, they were some of the best people I know, and gave us sort of a home to deal with. We were on the road at the time, so we didn't know anybody where we were. But over the next few years, I retrenched, very much retrenched, and had to rely on, you know, I wasn't ready to deal with both sort of the loss of a child and the loss of a religion at the same time. And the emotions are pretty similar. They're not dissimilar at all. So.
Oh, wow. Well, man, that's some heavy shit, man. I like that backdrop for the metaphor itself because, okay, so, I mean, I don't really want to go into that much about, like, what the metaphor means. I mean, it's pretty, you know, it seems pretty obvious.
It's not a subtle essay.
Right. But I know, I thought the slide from talking about what was, like, a staple of Mormon culture to being a metaphor for Mormonism itself and the Book of Mormon, it kind of went back and forth between those two. I thought that was very subtle, but I wanted to know, I mean, what were you kind of thinking when why did you pick like a food item?
Well, that's actually a little bit of a funny story, too, and relates to my daughter's death, actually. One of the ways I coped, and I coped with the increasing religious pressure around me, was to get into food. This is really easy when you're working at a big law firm, which I was, because, you know, the summer associate events are filled with every restaurant in the Zagat Guide you can possibly think of, and you have dinners and all this kind of stuff. So I actually ballooned up to a rather embarrassing weight. I got pretty fat. Started in law school and then really, you know, that kind of carried me over the edge. You know, you're working until 2, 3 a.m., you're ordering in dinner and billing it to clients, and no time to exercise. I had my brother and a few others proofread the essay, and I had to call my mom and say, look, this is about casserole, and she got offended a little bit. Said, I never cooked. And I'm like, I know you never cooked casserole, Mom. You never had it. But this is, you know, it kind of represented that there's a literal connection to food that I was using to self-medicate as sort of a way of getting through the emotional difficulty I was having. So, you know, that was part of it.
Right, right. And why casserole specifically? I mean, like, you know, there are a lot of very Mormon dishes, right? And you allude to some of those, like the funeral potatoes and that type of thing. But I'm curious about how you honed in on casserole itself. Yeah,
mostly because I actually really like Jell-O and funeral potatoes. Casserole, we actually never had it growing up because I couldn't stomach it. The cream of mushroom soup just did not work for me. But it sort of, you know, seemed as one of those quintessentially sort of Mormon dishes that's the same every time you eat it, no matter what else you put in it. Just kind of like sacrament meeting became the same every time I went, no matter who was speaking and who was talking. It was the same thing. So that was part of it. But part of it's because I think Jell-O is actually kind of tasty.
Oh, Jell-O's awesome. And Bill Cosby, I don't know, I can't disassociate Jell-O from Bill Cosby.
And those wild sweaters from the 80s, yeah.
Yes, exactly. It's great. I've actually been rewatching The Cosby Show. It was a little bit before my time. It's a good show, man. Anyway.
Yeah, no, it was as the only show we were allowed to watch. It was pretty fantastic.
Hey, did you? I have to ask. On Sunday activities, my parents were pretty strict. We weren't allowed to watch movies or TV or anything, but we were allowed to watch anything produced by the BYU film studio. So, like the phone call. Do you remember the phone call?
I do remember the phone call. Yes, I do.
And all those guilt movies from like the 70s, like Cypher in the Snow,
Cypher in the Snow,
The Letter,
the
and all that.
One, yeah. We were maybe a little bit more liberal as we got into my teenage years. Occasionally, and this was only because Steve Young was playing, we actually watched 49ers games. But Steve Young playing made it okay. It was now a Mormon activity.
Right, yeah. Right. No, I was actually in the same boat. We made the same distinction. Steve Young was playing. We can watch it. I actually watched his last game ever where he just got the shit knocked out of
him. Oh, man, did he get hit hard. Oh, he got plowed.
Yeah, that it was the Cardinals game. I'm from Arizona, so we were watching this Cardinals game, and he just got destroyed.
I think I may have been on my mission then. I can't remember what year that was. I've seen the hit many times since. Good on you for retiring, son. That wasn't bad.
Yeah, seriously. The football in general just seems kind of like a messed up thing. Yeah. I mean, they're literally killing themselves for our enjoyment, and we're just...
No, it's modern day gladiators.
Oh, totally. Yeah. So could you talk a little bit about like the relationship? Because you said, you know, your brother's proofread it, you sent it to your mom. I mean, what's the relationship in terms of your relationship with the church, and what do they know about it, and how do they feel about it?
They all know about it, frankly. I'm the last of the seven of us to leave, meaning children. And my dad, you know, I'd sort of let all of them tell their stories individually, although I will say that most of us are gone now at this point. I had family things and other sort of things to juggle around. It was a little bit more of a difficult and protracted exit for me than for them. But they all know, and they're all fine with it. Frankly, I've got a better relationship with my three brothers now than I have in some time, because there's no longer that gulf. And so, you know, we feel a little bit more open. Not that we ever had a bad relationship, but having the church gone has made that a much easier and friendly relationship, which is good, because, you know, we live apart and I miss them quite a bit. you know, on my wife's side of the family, it's been a little bit more difficult. They're very much believers, but it depends on the person. Generally, the reaction has been, well, you know, we're sad to hear that, but we still very much, you know, care about you, and we're not going to make our relationship any different. So we kind of get that. It didn't come as a surprise when it eventually happened, and when I eventually sort of said, yeah, I'm kind of backing off from this now, guys.
Yeah, that's a pretty common experience. In fact, I think the horror stories, I mean, they are horror stories because they're I think they're the exception, though. I think a lot of people have just kind of it just kind of happens.
They're noteworthy and sensational, and so they get the airtime, and they do happen. I know of some, but not mine.
Yeah. One theme that kind of kept coming up in the essay that I noticed was about, like, these references to, you know, your substantial girth and chubbiness and kind of basically the complacency, right? You just have this image, you paint this image of just this flabby, just kind of deflated man, you know, like just impotent man type thing. Like, is that, like, could you kind of talk about that in specifically, in your situation, but also specifically in, like, with the church?
Well, I mean, the intellectual stimulation was gone, right? So, you know, you come to Elders Quorum and you kind of, you go there and you start talking and you start pontificating about XYZ, and then you realize that XYZ didn't matter at all. In fact, there was one Elders Quorum I went to a while ago where he was probably 20, unmarried, you know, nice, good kid and all of that, especially by church standards, but went off on a diatribe about proper sexual relations with your wife. And I just kind of turned my head and said, son, you've never been married, and I'm guessing you're probably pretty virginal over there. You don't know what you're talking about. Not really helping us out a whole bunch. So mentally, you know, I was pretty stagnant religiously. You know, I'd been stimulated at school, that sort of a thing, but not really much more to branch out at that point, especially once I'd actually sort of read into the history and that kind of a thing. I always felt like I was holding back. I taught gospel doctrine for years and could play kind of a game of how much do I disclose versus how much I don't, and that was fun for a while, but it got to be kind of hard. Physically, I definitely followed. In fact, the whole story of coming out really involves the physical side, because one day I just kind of realized, you're fat. You're not big boned. You're fat. You can't make an excuse anymore. You know, for years I told myself, well, I've just kind of grown into my size, and that was ridiculous. So I started exercising right in the middle of this crisis. I started exercising, and I go back to just running, simple running. One night I'm sitting on a treadmill, and I put a towel over the readout and say, okay, I'm just going to run as far as I can. And I turn on my iPod and I just start counting the songs, and I stop counting the songs because that's helping me count the miles, and I just run and I run and I run, and there's this mirror in front of me, and it's like I'm trying to run towards myself but never quite getting there. But this feeling of getting towards myself and sort of seeking myself while I'm running but moving nowhere really resonated with me. And I took off the towel off of the treadmill when I felt like I was just going to drop. And I'd run 9 miles, which at the time was a lot. It was more.
I've never run 9 miles.
Not on a treadmill anyway. Now, that night, horrible physically. Physically, I was a mess. I was throwing up and dehydrated. My body wasn't ready to do that. And I was still, you know, probably at that point, maybe 60 pounds overweight, and my joints were icky. But mentally, I had reached something. And I still think I reached this. When you get to a point where you're just exhausted, your mind has to stretch and just kind of, you know, hit enlightenment almost, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, where you just are and you just exist. It's a weird feeling, and that may sound a little bit funky and esoteric, but that's what happened. And then a bunch of friends said, look, you've run 10 miles or so. You ought to think about a marathon. And I said, you're nuts. You're insane. I'm not running. You people are nuts. And they convinced me. I signed up for one. Figured I'd check it off the bucket list, and ran it. Had actually quite a bad race, and as far as races go, you know, had an injury, had to fight through that, but finished it. And the act of finishing that, and having lost the weight, and having that time to myself to think and sort of, you know, just be, was so powerful. powerful that when I finished, I just fell into a heap of tears at the finish line, and then immediately signed up for my next. And so now I've sort of replaced one religion with another, and which is sort of exercise. It's where I actually listen to all my podcasts, and for years I would, you know, download your major ones that you can think of. You know, John DeLynn and John Larson became good friends. And I would listen to those and sort of process and then come back home. And it just had a time to sort of think and think through. You know, I got sort of healthier, kept pushing myself to see how much farther and harder I could go. And it made a huge difference. It's sort of a different religion and, frankly, a very narcissistic religion. It's one in which, you know, I'm pushing myself, but I'm God anyway, so it doesn't matter. Yeah.
Right.
That's what it was.
Well, so that moment when you're talking about, you know, kind of just being – in my mind, I made a connection with the point in your essay when you talked about where you didn't – you turn to your wife and you say, you know, I don't want casserole. I just want a green bean. You know, I just want some snap peas, or green beans, snap peas, like not from the can, just, you know, natural food. I mean, is that kind of the turning point?
I think that was
does
part
that epitomize
of it.
That?
It was part of it, definitely. As a side note, last night, knowing I was recording this, my wife made casserole for the only time in our entire marriage. She made it last night. Good luck charm, I guess. I started off by going back to the fundamentals of Mormonism, saying, well, look, all this modern stuff is screwed up. There's no way you can equate this modern stuff with the stuff before. It just doesn't match. It's complete mismatch. So I said, okay, well,
modern, is that, are you talking like kind of post-correlation versus like Joseph Smith era?
Yes.
Or is that like...
It's, you know, in my mind, it's not quite that simple, but you can see kind of the line of demarcation in the 60s. And if you look at where we are today versus, you know, the sorts of stuff that were taught in the early days, it's almost a 180. You can, you know, go chapter and verse and compare Bruce McConkie with Orson Pratt and say, wait a second, they're saying the exact opposite thing. And you know, so that didn't match up. And I tried to go back to fundamentals and say, okay, let's just start with these simple things. Let's not have the full menu of church stuff. Not sure where the temple is. That's kind of weird anyway. Let's just go back to faith. We'll take faith for a while and we'll deal with that. Mm-hmm. You know, that was kind of a coping mechanism I had there for a while. But what it really was a reconstruction of my own morality. I realized it later. It was... because my morality had been based completely in Mormons and Mormon texts and strength of youth pamphlets and things preached from the pulpit, you know, the thinking very much had been done for me. And so I had to fundamentally break it down and say, okay, what are my morals? Do I think it's good to kill people or no? How do I feel about that? Let's ignore this stuff, killing people, yes or no? And then take it step by step. I did not kill anybody. I thought about it once or twice. And that was kind of taking these little tiny pieces and reconstructing, you know, what I thought about certain actions and certain things. Ended up more or less in the same place. Be nice to people and, you know, let's think about consequences. But ended up in different places on others.
Right. Okay, so this has been something that I've been kind of like struggling with recently. And I think it's a reason that this casserole metaphor resonated with me, and what you're talking about just being also resonated with me, because I feel like in Mormonism you don't really allow anything to exist on its own terms.
Yeah.
Like everything has to be processed through the Mormon lens until it all kind of asymptotes, it all kind of converges to this bland like worldview of everything has been leading up to this.
If it doesn't have your Mormon stamp seal of approval on the packaging, it's not acceptable.
Exactly. You know, my mom, we just had this conversation recently where she went to Arizona for some business, and she went to an Apache cultural event. It was some sort of ceremony, cultural event. And she's telling me that, oh, you know, all of these things about this ceremony they were doing were just like the temple. And I couldn't believe that of all the things of the temple ceremony that they had kept over from when they were Lamanites, you know, this had come through into this thing. And I'm like, they don't – they would be so insulted if you just came up and were like, oh yeah, by the way, oh yeah, we own that. Like, oh, that's us too. You're just secretly Mormon, just way far back so you don't remember.
I did the same thing in Japan. Glenn can tell you all about it. In fact, I think he already did.
Yeah, I think, I mean, when we talked to Brad, I don't know if you listened to that episode.
I did,
but
yeah.
Yeah, when we talked to him about, or when he talked, you know, he talked about that myopia episode, that minisode that he did, or I guess it was a full episode. Anyway, it was, but yeah, where you just kind of reinterpret everything. Nothing gets to exist on its own terms. Like, it's always processed through that Mormon lens.
Yes.
And
how dare you make cream of chicken soup on your own? You must buy the can.
Yeah, exactly.
Now to say all that, you know, at this point, and we're talking a couple of years ago here, my faith was completely decimated at that point. I didn't believe anything, you know, sort of was and still am very much an agnostic. But we were still going to church, still had in fact, I never actually failed a Temple Recommend interview. But what happened after that was, now that my paradigm had shifted, I was going to be fine just existing where I was and kind of not believing in some ways. It was boring. Got my iPad got a lot of use in sacrament meeting. I got busted playing something or other by some kid one week. That was fun. But then I started thinking about things, and it really changed a couple years ago. My oldest daughter, we were in the car driving one day, and she says, "What do I get when I'm 12? And I thought about it, and frankly, the answer, not a damn thing, is not a great answer, but it's the only one that's out there.
Yeah, that's true.
I started thinking about it a little bit, and my own perception had shifted, and that's when, you know, I got into sort of the more modern social issues. I've got a background in corporate finance. That's what I do, and so I was able to look at the, you know, sort of the corporate structure of the church and the finances in a new and unique way. Or at least in a way that I don't think a lot of people can do unless they have that kind of tools and those kinds of tools and that skill set. And what I saw there alarmed me. What are we giving our money to? We don't know where it's going. This scares me a little bit because I don't trust these guys anyway. I don't think they're bad guys, but I don't
right.
trust them. I trust them to kind of work like a company.
Right.
What are we doing about this women's issues here? What's going on here? This makes no sense to me. Where's your backup for this? And why isn't this just like, you know, giving blacks the priesthood? Because I'm sure hearing a lot of the same language.
Right.
And then, you know, I mean, in New York, it's New York. I met plenty of gay people. I hadn't before. We had some family members, but they were pretty heavily ostracized. These people are my friends. How do I tell them that I think that they're sinful and they shouldn't be able to get married? Well, that made no sense. And so I started reexamining all of these things. And that's when I made the shift from, well, look, you know, I can deal with this. The ward that I still live in is full of fantastic people. The leadership here is the exact opposite of all those horror stories. In fact, when I said, look, I'm not going to be doing this anymore, both the bishop, who's a close friend of mine, and the stake president are like, totally respect it. We're not going to sic the rescue on you. And I said, well, dang it, I was expecting cookies. Don't I at least get cookies? But that's when I made sort of the decision that, look, this is unhealthy. These are things that are going to hurt me. They're hurting my children. And I would go to church and just get angrier and angrier and angrier. And every week I'd come home and just start ranting. A couple conferences ago, I would remember just screaming profanity at the television. And I mean, literally yelling it at Boyd Packer. Then my wife, who, you know, well, her story is her own, a little bit different than mine. She says, look, you just got to go. You can't be doing this. This is not healthy for you. It's not healthy for us. I'm worried about all the same things you are, but, I can deal with it a little bit better. I know we've got friends here, but you've got to take this out of your life. These people will still be your friends. And they have been.
Right.
So I haven't had the bad ostracism, but I removed a very difficult and sort of unhealthy thing out of my life, and then it all got better.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the Zen moment, I think,
yeah,
of the journey out of Mormonism or away from Mormonism, is when you get to the point where it doesn't matter. Like, Because I guess in some cases, like if you're trying to prove the church true or false, you're still kind of accepting that paradigm that whether or not it's true or false actually matters. But it
doesn't.
Yeah,
it doesn't.
What matters is whether it's healthy, whether it's actually helping your life, and whether it's actually in the net helping people out. And if it's not, it doesn't matter if it's true. It's totally irrelevant.
I'm a total big fan of the flying spaghetti monster. That's good. And if that works for you, you do it. If it's healthy, and, you know, I can't see anything really wrong with wearing colanders on heads and driver's license photos. Good for people who do that. Right. But once it starts encroaching into something else, when you start saying, we're authoritarian, this is what it is. There's no room for thinking here because the thinking's been done. And by the way, the fact that all of this stuff mirrors what we did before with our pretty racist past, yeah, kind of ignore that, would you? Because we're wrong then, although Mike Tannehill has something different to say. But that's Mike. But we're not wrong now, and you know we're not wrong now because we're telling you we're not wrong now, and that's how you know. And in the meantime, you know, I'm seeing, and I especially look at the women of the church and see this huge difference between the women I work with professionally. I work with, you know, tons of just intelligent, bright women who are assertive. My boss is a woman who is just one of the smartest people I've ever met. And I'm not seeing the same actions by the women of the church by and large. It's not true for everybody, but you know, I sat in ward councils where you watch two women get cowed into not saying anything by, you know, eight men and that right. kind of a thing. And it's just not healthy for anybody.
No, absolutely. And you can't, I mean, there comes a point where it's hard to be complacent or hard to stand by where you're watching people and whole groups of people just get crushed in the wheels of this of this very corporatized, like, you know, stratified organization.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was doing my last little video about modesty,
which was fantastic, by the way,
I'm glad you liked it. When I was making that video, I mean, you know, part of like the process is like, you know, you really have to get inside the head of like what's actually happening to be able to mm-hmm. satirize it. And so, you know, the more that I would immerse myself in this modesty talk and these lesson manuals about modesty and these talks about modesty, and when they're mentioned, like I had no idea how pervasive and just pernicious this idea of modesty and you have to cover up your body and this fear of sex and the fear of your body was for women specifically. And I was just boiling with anger for days afterward because I couldn't believe how harmful it was.
Well, and it sends so many weird messages, like, you know, we have to make sure that our 5-year-olds are dressing in temple appropriate clothing. Well, that's ridiculous. Now you're sexualizing a 5-year-old, right? And that's really disturbing. Or, you know, okay, my daughter, you know, she may wear a 2-piece to the swimming pool now. Well, so what? It's, you know, if we all move to what do they call it, the burkini? You know, let's all move to the burkini. The fetishization is still going to happen. You know, it's not a coincidence, I think, that Saudi Arabia has a very high and very unprosecuted rape incidence. It doesn't matter. And it leads to funny consequences, like me as a teenager sort of, you know, looking at all of these Mormon girls I'm growing up with, but really secretly waiting for that trip to Disneyland with my family because there they sure dress like sluts.
Yeah, exactly. They, or go swimming, you know. It's like it's just a flash of a navel. Oh, you know, it's just.
I know. I made good use of sunglasses back then.
Oh, absolutely. You got to get those aviator, like, just totally opaque.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Mirrored. Absolutely mirrored.
The
yeah.
funny thing is, and this is way back in my youth, but just before my mission, I worked as a lifeguard at Seven Peaks. And you know, Seven Peaks is just sort of down there in Provo. You get that right. whole Mormon influence there. And I don't know if other lifeguards had this experience, but I saw an awful lot of unintentional nudity there. And without fail, it was always the girls in the one-piece swimsuits because of the way they're designed. They, unless they cross in the back, it's really easy on some of the speed slides for the top just to fall down, and they'd stand up, and I'd be there, you know, this 19-year-old kind of googly-eyed going,
Sunglasses.
And there's like, what? And then they look down and, of course, shriek because they're the very people trying to protect their virtue. Well, nobody lost virtue in that. You know, it's not their fault, and I wasn't complaining. Not my fault either. But you get really bizarre situations like that.
Yeah. And it just creates all this time. I mean, you know, the journey of the sexual maturity is just – it's going to be fraught with just terrible tension and awkwardness and weird experiences. And you don't have to, like, just pile up all this extra shit on there to just crush somebody, you know?
Well, and this was one of the revelations that my wife and I had. Now, I mean, a gentleman doesn't kiss and tell, so I won't. But it was it took us a while to realize how much we had let you know, Jesus, also known as the church, into the bedroom. And, you know, frankly, neither of us are into threesomes. So that had to get kicked out.
Right.
And that was, you know, kind of the revelatory process going, well, you know what, this can get booted out, and let's not deal with this anymore. We're not going to have this here. And that's made a huge difference in our own relationship.
Well, I think this kind of bleeds into, like, that final section of the essay when you're talking about how now my mind's open to all these different possibilities. You know, this spectrum of human experience is available to me that wasn't before. And, you know, I'm going to eat some weird goose liver and I'm, you know, but I'm also going to have great experiences that I love, and everything is counted as a blessing. But in what ways is, like, That foray into those other human experiences, I mean, how is that journey going? I'm sorry.
It's really been sort of it's been new and refreshing, and I'll use the stereotypical I'm evil apostate one. Let's talk about alcohol, right? Mm-hmm. So alcohol, mm-hmm. I mean, I never drank in high school at all, nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, the hardest stuff I'd ever had was cough syrup. You know, NyQuil, which I think is like, right, you know, 25% or something. Good luck getting drunk on that before you fall asleep. Mm-hmm. So when I got into this, I actually, you know, had a drink one night on a business trip, the exact thing that they say will happen when you're on a business trip. You know, at this point, my faith is gone. I'm saying, well, let's just try this out. It's safe. I'm just going to have one. There's no driving involved, that kind of a thing. And I found it kind of bitter and nasty, actually. And then, you know, a year went by. I'm on a flight home from Asia, and said, "Well, you know what? We'll have a glass of wine with dinner. They've offered it to me. I'll try it out." It was horrible. But then, you know, I kind of got into different different mode, and didn't really keep trying the same things. A dear friend of mine who I work with, you know, is not Mormon, and I'd kind of shared with her earlier on what kind of thing I was going through, and she, you know, gave me some advice. Says, look, you know, you're a professional, you're not 20, don't buy crap. You have the money to buy good top shelf liquor. Here's some beers you're going to want to try. In fact, she went out and got me a 6-pack sampler and said, these are some ones that are good to try. Why not take these home? And then I discovered little things like I get home from a run and I have a beer. Wow, that's fantastic. That's refreshing. That's magnificent, you know. And I'm not a heavy drinker, nor do I ever plan to be. But occasionally, hey, yeah, you know what? I'm gonna have a beer with my friends, or after I've had a hard run, or something like that. Or if I'm out at dinner, I'm not gonna worry about it. I'm a grown up, and I can determine whether or not I'm gonna be stupid about it or not. Things like that, you know, if you want to keep on the word of wisdom theme, there was a very specific moment I remember where we said, look, you know, we are ditching all these other things. Dang it, I'm buying a coffee maker today. So we went and I bought a coffee maker. And you know what? I think John Larson shared the experience of having a cup of coffee and just waiting for something to happen. You know, whether it be his
yeah, I remember that one, actually.
His attitude
yeah.
change, he got struck by lightning, I don't know. That kind of thing. But also just mental thought experiments. I don't feel bound by the strictures of the church anymore. I feel like You know, my relationship with both my friends and especially my family is much more open. You know, the kids know exactly how I feel about things, and I can have really honest conversations about my daughter, or with my daughter rather, and say, look, you're starting to get to this age now. This is when you're going to be going through this stage of your development. Obviously not in these words, but, you know, here is what a relationship looks like, and here's what you should look for in boys. And you're going to be going down this road where, you know, there's a gradual progression, and sex is a really adult thing, and you got to be ready for the consequences. So think about that very carefully. And if you're going to do it at this time, you know, do it in this, do it with this kind of protection, so you protect yourself against these consequences. And I'm not worried about, you know, sin next to murder. I'm just worried about loving my daughter and teaching her a good message that applies no matter what religion she's from. Just teaching her how to be an adult instead of how to be a sort of a Mormon in a state of arrested development.
Yeah, that's the thing, is I feel like it is a state of arrested development in some way. And that's going to sound really condescending to all the Mormons I know that are super great adults and all of that. But I really feel that way, that it's at some point when you just when you look at some spectrum of the human experience that could contain some danger.
Yeah.
And you just completely cut that off, then you're just limiting, you know, what adulthood is, what the human experience is being accountable about the choices that you make, you know.
And you understand the consequences and you move forward. And so, you know, if my 12 – and she's only 12. She turns 13 in a little bit. But if, you know, she if she goes down life, figures out when she's 16 that she's gay, you know what? We can deal with that. That's fine. I still love you. I'm not judging you, and I don't have some sort of stigma that's getting in between you and me. And if you go out and you're 21 and you decide you're going to move in with your boyfriend, hey, that's great. But let's have a talk about what's responsible and what's not. And you're 21. Let's not be in a hurry to, you know, to all of a sudden you know, have kids or something like that if you don't want to be. Mm-hmm. You know, make these good choices and. I approach it a little bit differently with my son, who's only about 8. You know, I have sort of a vision of the things I want to teach him. This is how you treat women, and here's the problem, and understand, here's the issue of male privilege that exists. It's a real thing, and so you have to be a little bit careful about this kind of stuff. And I can do that without sort of this big, heavy, looming auspice of when the prophet has spoken, that is the be-all, end-all,
right?
Which makes a huge difference in just my parenting ability.
Right, right. I feel like we've covered the vices of the church to a certain extent. Is there anything about, you know, your upbringing within the church that you're grateful for, maybe? I mean, it's not like I'm just looking for some sort of artificial balance, but I am curious about
that. And we do have a tendency, you know, those of us who have left, to sort of, you know, be all negative all the time.
Right.
I honestly think that it's filled with wonderful people. In fact, I've made myself a sort of resolute goal to not introduce any of the issues that I've had or that I deal with without to anybody who's not ready. I'm actually on Facebook, for example, I'm very quiet about things like this, just simply because my friends aren't going to take it very well independently. They're going to go through a lot of pain, and I'm not going to cause that. I'm happy to let them sort of live their lives in their own way. But they're all just excellent people, and I have a lot of respect for them, even if I think they're believing things that are a little bit less than forthright. I appreciate the family centrism that is preached, if not practiced.
Right.
You know, that sort of instilled some values in me that I still retain. I don't regret, you know, any of the past 30, you know, 6 odd years. I don't regret going on a mission. One of the things I learned when my daughter died is that you have to learn to let that go and accept who you are and what you've done without too much criticizing. And so I've had to do that with church stuff as well. But there's a lot of good things that it does. There's a huge potential I look at the humanitarian efforts they do on a local level. We had a hurricane come through here a few years ago, and watching people band together to go out, clean up, chainsaw, all that kind of stuff was magnificent. Odd as it may sound, I think Elders Quorum moves are great. In fact, I've asked the Elders Quorum president to keep me on the list just so I can come and help out with that kind of stuff, because it's a great welcome to our community, you know?
Yeah.
I think people should probably buy a little bit of pizza for those who help out, but that's just me.
Mm-hmm. And beer for the, you know, those who aren't necessarily Mormon.
I'll have a hip flask. I'm okay with that. I think that a lot of the people, and I'm seeing it more in the generation that's around our age and even a little bit younger, I think that they're less dogmatic and they're more practical. And to some degree, because they're in this environment where there's so many different questions bouncing back and forth, you're hearing Dieter Uchtdorf talk about doubts in a way you've never heard anybody talk about before in General Conference. They're having to deal with that, and so they're much – and it makes a difference that I don't live in Utah, where you're just kind of happy to see anybody, really. But there's generally a very good community, and I think, you know, that they're great people. I think that the potential for good, I think, the humanitarian aid infrastructure is fantastic. I think they could spend a lot more money there. But, I remember a few years ago going and just canning peanut butter at the church peanut butter cannery here, in my city. We went, it was like 2 a.m. We worked during peanut butter till like 5. We went out to Denny's afterwards, just had a good breakfast. And all that peanut butter goes to the food bank here. Well, you know what? That's great. That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
How can you say that's bad? Because it's just not.
Plus you get to see how peanut butter's made, which I never freaking even thought about, but that's crazy.
You know, I smelled like peanut butter for about 3 days after that.
Did you like – was that good? That seems like it would be a blessing and a curse in a way.
You know, most of my fragrances tend to be, either musk or leather, a little bit of that kind of a thing going on. So peanut butter was not my first choice for the social scene. Not bad, though.
Yeah.
You know, it was pretty simple to make, it looks like. Just need to roast the stuff till it's pretty good, and then they pour this hot goop into a jar, and there you are.
So because I remember when I was little, getting peanuts and trying to crush them with a fork to make peanut butter. So that was the last time I ever really thought seriously about how peanut butter is made. So I know it's not made by children wielding forks.
No, we tried to do the same thing. It didn't work out well. It's made by there is a machine that sort of heats them and crushes them. The peanuts get roasted, and there's a little bit of salt in there. The stuff that the church makes, I want to say, is pretty much just peanuts. There might be some sort of hydrogenated something or other in there that bind it all together, but I don't think there's much. It's pretty normal stuff.
Pretty normal stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's see, look, fact of the day, Infants on Thrones fact of the day, how peanut butter is made. Nick Bigney.
Don't quote me on that one because I'm probably wrong.
Now, it was at this point that Nick's lovely wife, Marin,
hello,
was able to join us for the conversation.
So in the moments when you're referenced directly in the essay, you know, there's one where, you know, he says he doesn't want any extra helpings of casserole. And then there's another one where, you know, your reference where he talks about, you know, wanting snap peas. And then another where you kind of come out and say, you know, I don't really buy this whole one true casserole, one true dish either. So could you talk a little bit about, like, where you were, you know, while he's going through this whole process, this whole casseroling?
Well, it was a long process. I would say that Nick was more into casserole than I ever was. I grew up in an area where we tried lots of different things, and I played basketball at lots of different churches, and attended funerals and weddings in a lot of different traditions. So I didn't experience the state obsession, I guess.
As he said it
in his essay. And so, you know, when he started letting go of the church a little bit, it was kind of a relief to me because he missed out on a lot. Like, I would take the kids to the park on Sundays in New York, and he would just mm-hmm. be at home because he was mm-hmm. trying to figure it out. And that was something that he was taught not to do.
Uh-huh.
Where I was roaming mountains on Sundays with my family. So sometimes you cling so hard to something without trying anything else,
uh-huh.
and it hurts you. Where if you have a real choice, then you can still love the casserole, and which I love the church a lot. I appreciate it. I'm still an active member. Nick called me a heretic, but mm-hmm. and maybe I am, but I've kind of, and Infants on Thrones has made fun of this, I think, of people building their own little ever-changing walls of the church, you know, and, uh-huh. and I definitely have done that, but I'm happy there.
Yeah, I think
own
that
it.
That's right.
I own
that, that is the key point, I think, is that being able to, and that was kind of a Zen moment for me when I realized, you know what, I don't owe the church anything, and the church doesn't owe me anything. But from this point on, I'm participating to the point, like I'm owning my participation in it.
Right.
And I'm owning the way that I'm looking at that. And you can absolutely do that. I mean, I think that it's hard to maintain that boundary within the church, but you can do it.
You absolutely can do it. And I think that the reason why I've never had any issues is because I've done that my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
I was a very rebellious teenager for a Mormon, mm-hmm. but I didn't want to do anything bad. Like, to me, the standards made really good sense. Mm-hmm. So I chose them. But there were things that I did rebel against, and I always got away with them because people liked me so much. You know what I mean?
Like, right, right.
Like, I could wear my short skirt, and I could wear, you know...
Right.
I wore pants to church when I was in high school sometimes. I mean, I just did what I wanted, and I never not loved.
Yeah.
So,
you know, in my case, I feel like my wife and I kind of have a similar dynamic in a lot of ways, is that she grew up in Utah County, but her parents were very like academic and liberal, you know, kind of liberal thinkers. And so she's always kind of existed outside of the church, you know, like she and the church have kind of intersected in some ways, but whenever they didn't, it wasn't the end of the world. I mean, she existed independently, but parallel to the church for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I was completely defined by it. So, you know, when I reacted against that identity, I was still living in context of that identity relative to that Mormon identity. And so I kind of flipped to the other side where she's moved much less. I feel like her movements and her reaction to this type of faith journey has been much less extreme than mine because she already had like a strong sense of self before. Not that Nick didn't, but I'm just saying.
Well, I don't, but I think that his sense of self was really, really wrapped up in the church, and that the decisions that he made were wrapped up in the church. And it scared me at first when he was making this transition, because I knew that his decision to marry me was wrapped up in my affiliation with the church. And I didn't know for a long time if he was still going to choose me. Like, I still wanted him. I didn't care what his religion was. I mean, I married Nick for the ideas that he had. And, I mean, he has a lot of qualities that I admire. But I didn't know what he saw in me.
That's rough. When did you realize that – or start forming the idea that his relationship with you was so tied to the church? Was that something you were aware of the entire time, or just that you became more aware of as he distanced himself away from the church and that tension started?
Well, I think that I liked him so much that I didn't care why he liked me when we were younger and we were getting to know each other. When he was on his mission, he had another girlfriend waiting for him, and I refused to wait. I would not wait for a missionary. That was just one of my personal standards.
Yeah.
And he's laughing at me right now because of my way of playing hard to get. But we wrote incredible letters to one another when he was on his mission. And that is when he decided that I was the type of person that he would want to marry, and not this other girl who had struggles with standards of the church.
The one thing that this reminded me of was and I remember this very distinctly, I was driving home, and probably not the best part for this kind of a discussion, but we had a discussion about the temple, and I called her up, and we were just chatting. I typically chat with her on the way home, and said, look, I don't believe this temple stuff anymore. It doesn't make any sense, and here's where it came from, and this is what it means, you know. And at that time, and I kind of still do subscribe to the thought of Joseph Smith creating another level of secrecy to go hand in hand with polygamy. And as I say this, you know, and I'm sort of bearing, this is the real moment when I'm bearing my soul to her. She gets really quiet on the phone, and she says, "Well, why do you value our marriage?" Then, if the temple is worthless to you, then so is our marriage. And there was no way I could convince her on that call that it was the opposite, that I loved her and needed her more than ever, because I felt that way, and that I was that much more committed to her because she was the one person helping me through this really difficult time. And what I decided to do, and she can tell you how successful I was, is just try to show her that I care about you. I love you. I care about you. I want to be with you. I know this is difficult and trying. And what happened was, I think our relationship improved quite a bit from that time because we weren't focused on, you know, reasons why we were together, or reasons why we got married, but reasons why we stayed together and focused on, letting each other know that we loved each other. I hope that it's made me more thoughtful and made me a better husband, and that I express it more. And that was a huge changing point in both our relationship and in my own relationship with the church. That was, I think, probably the lowest point, and that's when it started to move back up.
But I realized that was my own insecurity, and you just have to let that go.
Right.
You can't live life being insecure.
Thanks again to Nick and Marin for the essay and, frankly, excellent conversation afterward. We're always eager for more essays and content from our listeners that we can feature on our podcast. So if you have anything you'd like to submit, go to our website, infantsonthrones.com, and contact us there. And as always, if you have time, please find us on iTunes and give us a rating. We love feedback from our listeners. Anyone for the closing prayer?
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.